What's up, everyone? The Bad Brains with the new intro, courtesy of William Duvall. Sounding good, right? Sounding good. Welcome back to another episode of the show, episode 201. Last week was a doozy, episode 200. If you missed it, go back. Go back right now. Don't even listen to this. Just go back. Listen to 200. It was an amazing episode with William Duvall of Alice in Chains. And, I mean, I thanked everybody last week, but I just want to thank everybody again, especially you, for listening to this thing. Oh, my goodness. Man, 200 episodes. Woo! Well, we got a great episode today. Josh Ramsey of Mariana's Trench, Canada's finest. He's on the program. What a talent. What a story. A guy I have wanted to have on the show for a very, very long time. I'm so happy Josh was down to do it. And I'm so happy that you are here to listen to it. It is very cold outside. Pretty much wherever you live, it's cold. So whether you're in the car with the heat cranked or you're curled up under a blanket at home, sit back and enjoy, because this is a great episode. If you want to get in touch with me, it's real easy. You can email me, leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. You can also add me on social media. It's at Shane Told. You can add the show. Just Google it, Lead Singer Syndrome. It'll pop right up there. And if you want to help out the show, we have an option for you. Money bags over there, yes. If you got money to burn and you want this thing to continue to go for 205, 210, 250, 300 episodes, well, we need your help. And the best way to help is to join the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club. I know I called you money bags a minute ago. I didn't mean it derogatory at all, okay? All you need is $6. $6 a month gets you in, and it really, really is the reason that I can keep doing this and bringing you the quality entertainment that I do week in and week out. And of course, the $6, it doesn't just go to me. You get a bunch of cool shit. Bonus content, merch, patches shipped to your house, and you get to be a part of an amazing community of like-minded fans. The link to check it out, leadsingersyndrome.com/all access. I'm going to say that link again. leadsingersyndrome.com/all access. Seriously, check it out. If you like the show, please. This will always be free, but this is what keeps this thing on the air. Some quick news with my band Silverstein. We just launched our second live album, which is now available over at our store, which is silversteinstore.com. It is our entire first album live. And some of you may have seen us play it earlier this year. And last year, we did a big tour celebrating 15 years of the album, which is called When Broken is Easily Fixed. And we recorded it at just about every night of the tour. And we put together the best performances, and we put together a really, really cool live album. And since that album is recorded, well, not the best, you know, it was 15 years ago and we didn't know what the hell we were doing. It really is a cool record. So if you're a fan of Silverstein, if you're a fan of our old stuff, definitely check it out. SilversteinStore.com. We're also going on tour real soon too. So go to Silverstein 20 because we're celebrating our 20th anniversary, bringing out bands like 4 Years Strong and I the Mighty, friends of the show. I love them. You love them. It's going to be a good time. So Silverstein20.com for all your ticket needs. Well, that brings me to the end of the intro. So let's jump into it. And my conversation with Josh Ramsey of Mariana's Trench. Step one, step two, step three, repeat. Step three, the change. thanks for doing this. It really is great to speak with you. I'm a huge fan of just your whole thing. And when I mean, you know, your whole thing, just your persona, the way that you put together not only the songs that you craft, the albums you craft, your stage look, the way you present yourself on stage between songs. I think it's a really, really cool just career that you've, you know, had for yourself now for what? Almost 15 years, I guess, right? I mean, since you've been, you know, making it. So thank you.
Thank you. Shit.
Maybe I laid it on a little thick there. But I mean it, you know, I've been wanting to have you on the show for a long time. So yeah, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks, man.
So first things first, October 3rd, Marianas Trench Day. That's kind of a cool honor.
That was started by the fans. That was started by the fans because that was the date I think that our first album came out. Yeah. And just became this thing that I really had nothing to do with that. But they seemed to enjoy it. So hey, sure.
No, I love it. So is that a thing? Is that been a thing like ongoing for a few years? Because is that like a thing you have to like put something out or like, you know, you're like expected to do something every day, you know, every year. Okay. I mean,
yeah, I don't know. I guess this year, I guess we released a video on that day this year, I suppose.
You did, yes.
Yeah. But yeah, like I said, that was a funny, like that was just like a fan thing that got started and they seem to continue to enjoy doing it. So, I mean, it's weird to be like, hey, here's a day all about our stuff. Like that's kind of a weird concept for me personally, but you know, hey, what you
want to
do? Sure.
No, absolutely, man. And the video, speaking of it, it's called Don't Miss Me, from your great new record Phantoms. And the main, I mean, first of all, I love the turns that the video takes. Like it starts off like this sort of ominous, dark video and it gets absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, I always kind of wanted to do, I've waited my whole career because I've always wanted to do, not necessarily a video with puppies, but like, I've always wanted to take like a serious, like ballad type song and just do like the stupidest fucking thing I could think of with it as a video. So I was very excited to finally do that.
Well, it must have been difficult with all the dogs running around. I mean, I don't know if you're a dog person, if you own dogs yourself or anyone in your band does.
I have two dogs. One of them is in the video.
Okay, right on.
It was one of those days where like the whole concept of the video was it was a very simple idea. It was three of us that came up with it. It was myself, my girlfriend, and the director, and the idea evolved very quickly. It was just like, okay, the video is going to start serious, and then over a few seconds, then puppies are going to take over. And at first we're going to have fun with the puppies and then they're going to ruin the video. And then we're going to show that the crew can't keep the video going. And then the camera's going to fall over and puppies are just going to ruin everything. So it was like a 30 second concept. And then basically all of the scenes in it, basically like Emma, the director, Emma and I just went on Amazon and we literally just like searched for puppy costumes and whatever came. We had a green screen, so we just like kept putting puppies in different costumes and just improvising scenes. So like a good half of that video is just like improvised on the day.
Yeah, well, that's always the best. The best videos always come out like that, right? Because
I agree,
anytime it's like you read a treatment and like, you know, I've been doing videos. I don't know how many videos my band's made, probably like 20, at least. And every time it's like the director writes a treatment and it's like at 2 minutes and 13 seconds, this is going to happen. And then at two, and then like the video's done filming and it comes out and you get like the first cut and you're like, this isn't at all what the fuck the treatment said.
Oh yeah. What the hell is this?
So why bother, you know, just like on the day, come up with like film some funny shit, some entertaining shit and just go with it. I totally love it. That's the approach you take.
Did you ever see, At one point, I saw Noel Gallagher talking about making music videos because he famously fucking hates music videos. And his quote, it was something like, I hate that you have to get there at 5 a.m. and you don't leave until 5 a.m. the next fucking day. And somehow every shot is like the most important shot and the director's acting like he's making Apocalypse Now. And like, actually, we're just fucking around and lip syncing. I guess.
No, it's true. And that's probably the truest thing Noel Gallagher has ever said. and maybe easiest to follow as well. Yeah, no, it's so true, man. And like, yeah, it's some of the things that you'll hear like a director like arguing with the crew about, like, you know, some lighting or some bullshit. And it's like, God, in the end, you know, it's like that shot's not even going to be in the video. Or if it is, it's in there for like a second. So I really don't like making videos at all, but it sounds like you found a way to make it fun.
Well, I actually don't mind it. Like the only thing that sometimes is like challenging for depending on what video we're talking about, but like usually I find that like I end up being a guy who has to like get injured in some way or something. We did one video where it was supposed to look like we were in a house that was flooding, but the way we shot it was we actually were outside and we built a set on top of a pool that we could just lower in and out of the pool.
Oh, okay. Yep, that's cool.
But what that actually meant was that I just spent all day on set outside soaking wet in like the fucking wind. And it was just like, we had to eventually call it because I started to get hypothermic by the end of the day. Cause I was like, I couldn't stop shaking and stuff.
it's brutal, man. We filmed one video one time on a frozen lake, like up in, I don't know, Parry Sound or something, but
Jesus.
It was like, it wasn't February. It was like late March. So the ice was kind of sketchy. And of course the video involved us playing in like around a ring of fire, I guess. So the whole time we're worried about the ice and falling through the ice, and someone came and checked the ice and basically said, yeah, I can't really say this is safe. So we went with it anyways, worried about falling through the ice. But what happened was our drummer ended up getting caught on fire. So by the fire we didn't even think about the fire being dangerous.
Oh my God.
He was okay, you know, but it's still like, yeah, videos can be dangerous because you're almost always putting yourself in some situation that's supposed to be, you know, surreal or like, you know, it's just the nature of it.
And especially for us Canadians where we're not working with the Katy Perry level budgets and fucking fly by night and just trying to get it done.
Exactly. Another video story I'll tell you really quick. We did this video and we were filming it in this like kind of decrepit like old house, and it looked pretty cool, but the floors were really sketchy and it had been raining, and and everyone in the band, like I was filming something else, the band setting up the gear, and the band kind of comes to me and is like, Shane, I don't think we can film like in this house. The floors are sketchy. I'm like, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. And of course I take a step the wrong way and I pogoed right through the floor and I fell like from the main floor into like the basement or cellar of this like old shack. And I was fine. It was like, I like fell through the floor and was like, where'd everybody go? And it's funny because that wasn't planned in the video or anything. But now it's all anyone talks about in the video because we put it in like so it's the last scene. Like I fall through at the very last minute. And everyone's like,
you guys kept it in the cut.
Yeah, we kept it. It worked to keep in like the very last, like I fall through and then the video goes black. So it's funny how the unexpected things in videos can end up being like all anyone, you know, ends up talking about.
That's really funny.
Have you seen the video, or it was like a viral thing I saw, of the woman on stage with Noel Gallagher playing the scissors?
No.
Yeah, she's like in front of a mic, like with scissors, just like the sound of scissors, like you know,
like as a percussive
as
instrument.
As a percussive instrument, yes, on stage. Yeah. This is a person. She's getting a PD to do this, at least. She's got a bunk spot.
That is really, really funny.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's definitely, anyone listening to this, definitely look up the lady playing the scissors for Noel Gallagher. 100%, 100% worth it. So I want to go back to the beginning a little bit and talk about your origins. Vancouver's finest, dude. Vancouver, BC. I know your parents were musicians. I know you had some trouble in school and actually involving like drugs. And you had kind of a tough upbringing, but you seemed to turn out all right. So talk to me a little bit about the early days and obviously how music kind of seems like it was like a language in your house almost. I mean, how important it's been to you.
It definitely was a language in our house for sure. My mom had been a touring musician. She was a background singer in Leonard Cohen's band. So she sort of spent the 70s on the road. She had all sorts of crazy stuff, man. She was like, she did the Leonard Cohen gig. She was in the original Muppet show when it was just a Vegas act. She had all sorts of crazy, crazy showbiz stories from my mom.
Wow.
And then my dad was also like a touring musician. He was a drummer and a singer in like a jazz trio, like, you know, in like the 60s, those acts that were like, you know, half lounge acts and half comedy, like those type of thing. Like a Vegas lounge type gig. So he was doing that. And they met each other working on a CBC show that was like a variety show. And then sort of my dad decided he wanted to get off the road, and sort of my mom and my dad, and two of his buddies decided they were going to start writing, jingles for advertising. And then as stuff started to go better for them, they got more gigs. They decided they were sick of renting studio time places. So they decided to take out a big loan and build a studio. But then the studio fucking blew up and it ended up getting so busy that they were having to go and rent studio time at other places to record their jingles because like such big band, like, cause it was like the engineer that they hired was a then not known young talented man named Bob Rock.
Oh my God. That's crazy. Yeah. I was thinking of Vancouver, producers. And I guess Bob Rock is obviously the one that comes to mind first.
For most people, Bob was like the house. Yeah, sure. And they all worked there. The studio was called Little Mountain and they all worked there. So it was like they built the place to do advertising, and then Bob was like, "Can I bring in bands on the weekend?" But then it was like Metallica and like it's kind of like really cool. So when I was a kid, by the time this all happened before I came around. So when I was a kid, if I went to work with my dad, it was like, you know, it would be like Bon Jovi was recording or Bryan Adams or Aerosmith or like any of the, like all of those acts that all recorded at that studio. And then all of the singers, my mom had gotten off the road and become a vocal coach. So all those singers that while they were recording at Little Mountain, they would also be coming to our house and taking lessons with my mom. I just thought as a young kid, I just thought when you grow up, you become a successful musician. Like I thought that's what like every adult did. Like it made it seem super realistic to me because I like all of my examples of adults were that. And like once I was like, you know, 7 or 8, I started to figure out that there were like other professions and stuff, but like I was kind of already locked in at that point.
That's interesting. You must have had a different, and maybe you still do have a different impression of what like a rock star is, because you got to see the personal side of them, like who they are and all that, you know, whereas when I was your age, like growing up in the Toronto suburbs with no connection to the music industry whatsoever from my family or anything, you know, I would look at, you know, you bring up Bryan Adams, who's one of my favorite singers of all time. Like I would never be able to just that guy's not even like a human being to me. That guy is just like, he's like a god, you know what I mean? Or Steven Tyler or whoever, man, you know? So that must be, I don't know. You must've had a different mentality, I guess, than other people, you know, that were not yet successful in, you know, getting to it.
I'll tell you one thing that really taught me from a young age. To me, it like fame or like rock star or whatever, like that never held any mystique to me. Like that never held any mystique to me. And it still doesn't. it definitely taught me to be like not one of those quote unquote showbiz people. Like there's a lot of entitled people once you get to that level. But you know what, man? Speaking of Bryan Adams, I had never seen him before, and a friend of mine had a box to go to see his show. So my girlfriend and I went along and saw him. And this was like this year or?
Yeah. I saw him this year too, or last year. Yeah, I saw, I think.
And I had never seen him before. Yeah. I had never seen the guy before. He fucking came out. He goes for no opening act, and he goes for like 2.5 hours. And I've never bought one of his albums, and I knew every fucking song. I was like, holy shit, dude, what a catalog. And he still sounds exactly the same. Like I wouldn't have expected a smoky voice like that to have held up over time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, he fucking sounds as good as he ever sounded on any of the recordings. Like, I have no idea how he has managed to maintain his voice that way, but like, that dude is for real some shit.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually saw him. I live in Windsor now. I saw him at the Caesars Windsor, which I think you guys played too. I remember seeing you guys in the casino, like on the posters. And it was the same thing. I think the door, like the ticket or whatever, said like 7 o'clock. So I'm like, okay, well, you know, and I got there at like 7:15 and I was like missing the first song. It's like, this is like, what show actually? It's like, I'm not going to a movie. Fuck, even movies have previews. So I was so surprised, but you're right. Like, he just played like banger after banger. And in fact, I remember like in the first, let's call it, half the show, he'd already played like Heaven and Everything I Do and Run to You and Cuts Like a Knife. Like, he'd play all these hits, and I was like, shit, I think he's like played everything. And then you're right, they just kept coming, and then it was like and even some of his newer songs, which I didn't think I knew, I guess just being Canadian, you just you hear him at the Bay or something when you're shopping at Christmas. I don't know, but yeah, he's incredible.
He is.
Growing up though, was there anybody that came through, you know, one of the studios or took lessons from your mom where you were like, holy shit, this guy's in my house? Or was that like, you just
I didn't understand, like that was just like always a reality in our house. So like, I didn't understand the concept of like famous people and that kind of, I didn't get it.
Yeah. That's really interesting. So talk to me about, like, you're going to school. And I guess, I don't know, you're getting into trouble in school. I mean, I read on just literally on your Wikipedia that, you know, you were like addicted to heroin at some point when you were a teenager.
That's true.
That's really, I mean, Vancouver is known for that stuff, sadly. But, you know, that hasn't been, I haven't heard you talk about that really much in interviews, like in any great, you know, level of depth. But that's a very intense thing to have happen to you early in your life.
I wouldn't say it happened to me. I would say I happened upon it. I have no one to blame for that but myself, for sure. But yeah, I was like, you know, it was, I don't know. I was like, I don't know what the draw was. I just did it. It was like me and another friend. And it started when I was like, I think I was 16. And then, I got kicked out of school for it, and then my parents told me to go to rehab, and I was in rehab by the time I was 18.
Wow. And since then, are you sober? Have you been sober like your whole kind of adulthood, or is it something you've at all wrestled with?
I've never gone back there, and I stayed sober from absolutely everything for at least, I don't know, 10 years, and I drink alcohol now.
Okay. Yeah, that's good, man. That's good. I'm glad that you're doing okay. You know, these days with how much focus there is on mental health, especially of musicians, you know, I think it's important to talk about. And a lot of times it gets kind of pushed aside, and people don't want to talk about it. But I think it is kind of important. So thanks for sharing.
I got no secrets. I'm an open book on that. The only thing I do think, and I agree with you on the mental health thing, the only thing I don't like is I don't appreciate when I see celebrities weighing in on mental health issues like they're a fucking expert and they have no training on the subject, because I think that can be very irresponsible and dangerous. Because, like, you know, when Tom Cruise is sitting there talking about how postpartum depression doesn't exist or like some nonsense like that, mm-hmm. I think some I think some of that shit can be pretty dangerous as well. So like, I totally agree with you on the mental health thing, but my personal philosophy is always to talk to someone who has actual training on it and don't look for two celebrities for answers.
Well, totally. Especially, I'm sure you have fans that are struggling, especially if they have heard that you had a problem with drugs in your life. And they're going to come to you and they're going to go, Josh, like, I'm having trouble. Like, and then they come into me too. And I always say, look, I can give you advice. I can tell you something, but take it with a grain of salt. Please consult a professional. Because as much I don't want to be responsible if I tell you the wrong thing, because I don't fucking know. I'm just a dude. Like, my life is probably in some ways more fucked up than yours.
I try and be responsible as much as I can.
Yeah, absolutely. So I heard you play 13 instruments. Is that correct?
I'm not sure.
I don't even think I can name 13 instruments. So that's impressive. Did you learn all those skills from growing up having instruments around the studio? Because, you know, a lot of times like there isn't just like a, I don't know, I assume you play like instruments like woodwind instruments or brass instruments. Those aren't always just kicking around.
I think to me, honestly, like the multi-instrumentalist thing is like, yeah, I could play a bunch of stuff, but like, am I awesome at any of it? No, not necessarily. But I am functional on all of it. I think like, I don't know what you think, but like, I think it's like, if you learn music theory really well, and that's kind of really like the language that we're using, after that, it's just learning techniques. Like it's still the same notes. It's still the same, like the notes fit together the same way they do on every other instrument. It's just kind of like figuring out like, how do I make this thing go? You know what I mean? Like, I think like the theory thing is the more important thing, because you can apply that to every instrument.
Absolutely. Well, how did you learn about theory? Was that just trial and error? Did you learn it in school?
A little bit of everything. Like I, as a young kid, I could hear it before I knew what it was called correctly, if that makes sense. Like I could hear the difference in things. And then I would ask my parents questions. And like I said, like my parents, like they would just speak to each other. Like dinner conversation in our family was there. Very music theater based or music theory based.
Like your dad's talking to your mom being like, I can't believe this guy wanted to harmonize that whole part in fifths.
Yeah, exactly.
And your mom would be like, oh my God, yeah, that sounds so mechanical. And you'd be like, wait, what does that mean, mom? What's a fifth?
Right? Yeah. Or like my our family road trip game would be like, my dad would be like, okay, I'm going to sing this note. You sing this note, you sing this note, you sing this note. Everyone go over that. And that's a C7 chord. Like that was kind of like a, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's very cool. Well, one of my favorite things that you did, I just love it so much, is the Pop 101 song. Like some of the things you hit on. I'm getting another call. One second. Sorry, you're still there. Like how you're talking about, well, it's really cool because the things, as you talk about them in the songs, you're doing them. And I don't know if the average listener understands that. Like when you say I'm harmonizing in thirds, not fourths, and you harmonize that part in thirds, or you talk about a 1-4-6-4 chord progression, which, well, I never like actually figured out, but I assume that that's what the song chord progression is. You know, and it's putting that together, like, you know, isn't as easy as maybe people think.
That's probably one of the most difficult songs that I've produced, I would say.
Yeah, especially all the things that come in and out of it as your subject matter changes, you know.
It's got a lot of moving parts for sure. And I mean, like I straight up was like, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to write a song about writing songs and we're going to point out everything that everyone else is doing. And like, we're going to lightly make fun, but also a bit of a tip of the hat. And like the lyrics are going to describe exactly what's happening in the song at every moment. So I went in with that idea and like, cause I have a studio, right? So like I record as I'm writing, and it's kind of just like one process. So it was like, every time I wanted to change a lyric or I wasn't happy with the lyric, we had to fucking like re-record sections of the song. And like, there was like that song took quite a long time to put together. The funny thing was, is like, That was the first song that we did when we were signed with Cherry Tree and Interscope. So that was like going to be our first like big US release.
Right.
And the funny thing was like everyone was behind it. Like all the music industry people were like, "Oh man, this song's going to be huge." And then we released it, and it was initially kind of like music industry people liked it, but the sort of like average fan base people kind of rejected it at first, because I think that was one of the first times I was like, maybe not everyone is like necessarily listening to all the lyrics all that clearly. Cause like the first responses to that song were like, it's so pop. I'm like, yeah. Listen to the fucking title. I think with time and stuff, like now when we play that song at shows and stuff, like now it's a big fan favorite, but like, it really like that one like took a long time to get people to come around. And I just kind of like that was sort of what I took away from it. It was like, I think maybe I'm paying attention to lyrics more than everyone else.
Right. Well, that's the thing, is not everyone grew up like you, Josh, you know?
yeah, that's fair enough.
So absolutely. Well, you bring up the US, and you guys had, I mean, you guys, obviously the success in Canada has been really amazing with, you know, the Juno nominations and awards and the, you know, arenas and that you play. But you guys have had kind of a slow start in the States. Like, you didn't even play a show until 2010, if I read that correctly.
Yeah. So, we were signed by 604 Records in Canada, which is Jonathan Simkin and Chad Kruger's company. But we were only ever distributed and marketed in Canada. We didn't have a deal in the States.
Yeah.
So no one knew who we were. And then eventually we decided to just be like, you know what, fuck it. We don't have a label in the States. We don't have a single. We don't have anything on the radio. But let's just go down and see if people come out to the show. Who knows? And they did.
Yeah.
And sort of since then, every time we go, it's bigger and bigger and bigger. Like, we're not doing arenas there, but it's turned into like, somehow we're this, like, we definitely have like a respectable touring business in the States now, which I'm super thankful about. And it's funny. It's like, it's a little bit different than when we tour in Canada, just because like in Canada, like people have known us for a long time. Whereas I think in the States, it's like people that have found us, actually, you know, this isn't just the States. It's like Europe is like this, and Australia is like this as well.
Right.
Like, people who have found us organically through either word of mouth or online, and they found us themselves. So the energy at those shows is a little bit different, because it's kind of like we're a bit more of like a rarity. You know what I mean?
You're kind of like a punk band in those places, right? Where in Canada, you're super mainstream. But no, it must be really different on tour, because like, I'm sure maybe you do it. I mean, everybody's different on what they can get away with, but you're a pretty recognizable guy. I assume like if you're playing somewhere in Canada, it might not be a great idea to walk to Harvey's to get a veggie burger or something. But when you're in the States, like you can go, oh, there's a Del Taco down the road, I'll just go. Like, you know what I mean? It must just be a different vibe. Like, obviously you probably bring less production, less crew, you know, stuff like that. Everything's a little smaller. And in some ways that must be kind of fun to like, you know, not have to play like a gigantic arena in Canada. You can wear this, the barricade is so far. It's like, you can play a show maybe with no barricade sometimes, which kind of must be like a little bit fun to kind of switch it up.
It is fun. I find like, I don't know if you find this, but like your bigger shows, you can do like more theatricality, but your smaller shows, you get more like intimacy with the audience, which is a different vibe. And like, there's something about that. Like, I mean, you know, there's something about like, you know, playing like a sweaty, packed fucking club where they can't fit in one single more person legally. And there's like a crazy energy in the room. Like that feeling is, it's wicked. We do still tour with, probably more production than we ought to when we're touring in, because I want it to still feel like, I just wanted to, if we're on the tour, like the show will have like video content, and we usually have like a narrative sort of storyline going through. So it's a little bit like a play as well.
Right.
So like, we can do more of that, like bigger video walls and stuff like that in Canada, but we still travel with that stuff in the States because I still want people to feel like they're getting like a pared down version, but it's still the same show.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You talk about the intimacy and the crowd and everything. One thing I really like about what you do is live, like the comedy aspect of what you do is real, but it's obviously all like off the cuff. Like you can plan your big production and all of that. And in some ways there has to be some segues that you have to do, you know, with the set list and the lighting package and all that. But there's stuff like off the cuff that you just come up with that is very good. Like you're obviously a very funny dude.
Why? Thank you, sir.
I mean, does that come from any other artists? Because there aren't that many artists that really do that. You know, you take yourself very seriously with songwriting and production, obviously.
I just don't take myself all that personally in real life. I never have. Like, I don't know. Like, you know, man, like you guys have been around for a while as well. And like, I just feel like the music industry can be like it's fucking hard, man. Like it's fucking hard coming up and like trying to get a name for yourself. And I don't think I could have survived all like the years of like the hard, shitty touring in a van where it's like just you guys and you're loading your own gear and you're sleeping for like 2 hours and then you're doing it all again. And like all of that stuff. And like, then you show up and there's like fucking three people at your show and someone says you fucking suck and like all of that stuff. Like, I feel like you can't get through your baby band years unless you have a good sense of humor about things, or else you're just not going to make it, man.
No, absolutely. The people that take themselves too seriously, like, you know,
I also, do you ever notice this? Like, when you, like, we've been fortunate enough to mostly tour with great artists that are really fun. And there's been a couple that you know, have not been, which I won't name. But you ever notice, though, in the music industry, do you ever notice that the people who act like a really big fucking deal always suck?
Always. Like 100% of the time. You know? Like some of the coolest guys I've ever met and still talk to all the time to this day brought us on our first big European tour. They brought you on your first US tour, and that's Simple Plan.
Those guys are awesome.
They're awesome guys. They sound great. They write great songs. They're the best. And they're very successful, very popular, and they just get it. You know? And it's always the case of what you said. 100%, man. You absolutely nailed it.
It's just like the guy, if you need to, like, if you're the kind of person that needs to act like a big deal to the guy who's taking out the trash, you might want to like revisit some things.
I know. One of my rules is like, in my life, I will never say the words, "Do you know who I am?" under any circumstances.
Right. Fucking hell. You know, that's funny that you say Simple Plan. I actually think Simple Plan, we toured with them. They did take us in the States. We did a deal. Like they did it was like, we were at a stage where we were like, that was our album cycle where we did move up to playing arenas in Canada, but we hadn't done an arena tour yet. And so we did a deal where like we would open for them on a Canadian arena tour if they agreed to bring us into the States for a tour. And it was like a great, we all had a great time and it was awesome. But you know what, man, like, I'm so glad that we didn't just jump to trying to headline arenas ourselves. And I'm so glad we did an arena run opening for them, because first of all, like I did not have the experience in a room that size. And working with those guys, it really taught us how to be classy headliners, like how to treat the other acts with respect and be nice. And there's still some stuff that I took away from those guys that I learned on that tour. Like, for example, like at the beginning of every tour, we always leave a bottle of champagne in the other band's dressing room and say, "Welcome to the tour." And like, and that's totally something I learned from those guys.
No, absolutely. That stuff goes a long way, for sure.
It does. You know,
a lot of times bands do like, an end of tour, like party. And it's like so funny, especially when you're touring Canada, because the tours are so much shorter than if you're doing a US tour. But sometimes like, you know, after just maybe it's 2 weeks in Canada or something, by that point, and you maybe only playing 10 shows, you haven't, like, every member of the band and crew, they maybe haven't even really met each other yet.
Yeah, so yeah, right?
What
yeah.
we started doing a while back is, well, let's have the end of tour party on the first day. Like, yeah, let's get yeah. to know each other on the first day. Why are we waiting till the end to, like, you know, it's embarrassing when you're like, oh, by the way, like, we haven't formally met. I'm Shane. Like, that sucks. Like, but yeah. so that's like, that's another thing that we've taken away. But you're absolutely right. I think Simple Plan took us out in 2006 in Europe. And like, yeah, they absolutely showed us the ropes of exactly how to act. So that is, yeah, that yeah, is very cool, man. A couple more things. I don't want to take up your whole afternoon there in Vancouver, but, your songwriting. I mean, I'm a really slow writer and it takes okay. me a long time to write. I'm sure you're much faster than me. I talked to a guy on the last week's episode who has written, recorded, and released 4 full-length albums in 1 year.
What?
Yes. Yes, he has done Whoa. It. His name is Scott Sellers. He was in a band called Rufio, a punk band, and they're pretty good too. Like, they're good. So
yeah, I was gonna say, how's the quality control?
Yeah, no, it's actually pretty good. But I'm just wondering, you know, how you go through periods of time, if you have periods of time when it's difficult to write, how you overcome that, and kind of what tips you'd give to, you know, either people struggling with that or slow writers like me.
Oh man, I don't know, like, dude, honestly, like, I don't think I'm specifically a fast writer or a slow writer. I think I don't know what your process is, but like, I try and just like listen to what the song wants. And I'm not trying to force it. Like, I find like when I try to force an idea, that's when it turns out shit. Mm-hmm. Just letting a song take as long as it takes. Like, I've had songs where like the whole thing just kind of like popped into my head literally in like 30 seconds. That's happened. But then I've also had like, we had a song on our previous album that was called Astoria. We had a song called Wildfire, and like that took me like 15 years to write. Like, right. I had the verse like before we released our first album, and I just like couldn't find a fucking chorus. So I just put it away, and like just like one day, 15 years later, a fucking chorus popped in my head, and I went, oh, hey, cool, that goes with that old verse. Sweet. Like, I, you know, but or other songs might just like pop right in. I also find like for me, like, how do you feel about this? Like, when I start to like start to write an album, that usually means we're at the end of a touring cycle. And I feel like, I always feel like the first few songs I'm really slow to write because like my writing muscle is out of shape.
Yeah.
But then like towards the end of the writing the end of the album process, then ideas are just like falling out of me. You know what I mean? Like as the momentum grows, you know?
I agree with you completely. I also wonder if it's like a pressure thing too. Is like, you get off the road, it's like, okay, it's time for a record. And you're putting a lot of pressure on yourself to come up with something. Whereas when you've already written, like, you know, let's just say 10 or 12 songs that you think are pretty good, or you've already recorded a bunch of them, then you're like, it's all pressure's off. And now it seems like, you know, if only you could have that at the beginning. I don't know. But yeah, I've heard a lot of people on this podcast say, yeah, like I got to kind of, you know, shit out a couple bad ones first and get that out of my system. And then, you know, the good stuff, you know, starts to flow. But, you know,
there's definitely like a flow to making an album for me, like for sure. It's not necessarily like that I need to write a couple of bad songs. It's more just like the first couple might take me a few weeks to write and record the first couple. Whereas like, I'll say we sort of like part of our thing has definitely been like I try and put like as much sort of passion and stuff into the album tracks as the singles. I find it kind of like freeing, like doing like, and it's kind of like become one of our like things, having sort of like free form, like long 8-minute songs at the beginning of albums stuff. And those songs, those are always the ones that I write last, like on. And the funny thing is those ones, usually because I'm coming from a super inspired place, because I'm at the end of the album process, usually those ones are actually like the ones that are easiest for me. Like they just kind of like, they just fill themselves in. Like on the album we just did, the last song is like, it's like an 8-minute all over the place full symphony kind of song. And it was like, we had to start, you're gonna appreciate this, I'm sure you've been there, we had to start mixing the mix session for the album started on January 1st. and on Christmas Day, I had no ideas for what the last song was going to be. I had zero ideas and hadn't started. Wow. And the whole thing happened between Boxing Day and New Year's. And it's like a very involved all over the place song. Somehow, like, I was just like in the mindset of like, I was just like more inspired at that time. And I was like also more confident because I knew like I had the rest of the record all done, you know?
Yeah. Well, having some pressure helps too, I think, as a songwriter, you know?
I wish it fucking didn't, but it does, man.
Yeah. Like some of the best lyrics I've ever written, we had like an instrumental and like the next day I knew I had to record it. And I wrote it the night before, and it's some of my favorite melodies and lyrics I've ever come up with.
Yeah.
Like, and I put myself in a hole, and sometimes I almost know I'm doing it because I know, okay, this is like going to count for real. Because I know that if I have to record something in like, oh, well, we're not actually going to record this for like 2 months. Well, I'll come up with something and I'll be like, this line's like fine, I guess. I'll probably change it later. But then I start, then I don't end up changing it because I like get used to it and I've like, you know, it's kind of a problem. So as much as my band hates when I do that, I sometimes think that that's just the way that I work best, you know?
Yeah. Like I agree. Like I wish that I didn't do my best stuff under pressure, but I do. Yeah.
What about Call Me Maybe? Cause that's a song that you wrote with Carly Rae Jepsen, obviously a huge hit. And a song that seemingly everyone knows you wrote. Like it's kind of interesting. Like I don't know who wrote, like when I listen to the radio, I don't know who wrote whatever songs, but for some reason, like everyone seems to know you wrote Call Me Maybe, which is kind of cool, I guess. But also, you know, it's almost like it's a Mariana's Trench song in some ways.
I don't feel like it's a Mariana song. And I, like, full disclosure, like Carly and I wrote that 50-50. Like I can't take full credit for that. We have equal parts of that song. I don't know that, you know, that song was, I never saw it. That was a real surreal experience that the life of that song. It was like at the time, Carly and I were friends and we worked together before and our only real goal was to get her like a top 40 song in Canada. Like that was all we were after. And then all of a sudden, like I still remember, like I was on vacation. I took my parents to Hawaii and we were there and the song had already come up and then it was going down again in Canada. And then all of a sudden I got a text message from my manager being like, Justin Bieber just tweeted about the song and all hell's breaking loose. And I was kind of like, okay, like that's not going to mean much. And I kind of just like put my phone down and went about my vacation and like didn't really think twice about it. And then I got back home a week later and it was like the biggest song on the planet. I was like, what the fuck? it was fucking surreal, dude. I was very and it had like a weird, crazy life too, because like it had its radio thing, and then it was like then it got cool for celebrities to do like lip syncing videos for it, and then it was a meme, and it was a this, instead of that, and it was just like this huge viral life as well. And I just like you can't. I wish I could say there was some magic formula to predicting something like that, but there isn't. That was like lightning in a bottle.
No, there isn't. I remember it was. Murph from the Wombats, who was on the program maybe a month or two ago, and he called songwriting something like, he called it like, you know, like a fucking dark art or something. And, you know, and he's like, you know, I get into this and I start writing songs and like, I don't know what's going to happen and I don't know what's going to come out and I don't know what's good. I don't know if I'm going to be able to do it. And it's never the same. Like every other, you know, thing that people do, there's like a process. There's like a sort of a formula, and songwriting you think would be the most formulaic thing on the planet because it's literally every pop song is structured like, you know, only a few different ways you can really do it, you would think, but that's not true. You can write a song in 30 seconds, well, maybe not 30 seconds, 5 minutes that is popular, and you can write a song in 5 years that's garbage, and to you, one could be way better than the other. But with Call Me Maybe, did you know it had that magic? Did you think it was one of the better pop songs you'd written? Did you think it was in the middle? Did you think it was okay? Or did you just not even know?
I was happy with it. I don't know. I was happy with it.
Right.
I think to me, the other funny thing with like, you know, hit songs and shit is you can do your best and it can be an awesome, you can have like the best song ever. And it, for whatever reason, it just might not get traction. Like there's so much luck involved in terms of like putting something out there. Like, you know, you could put something out and just like, I found things like personally, like what time of year did it come out? Was it the right song? Was it the right song for the season? Like, I'll be honest with you. Like, we just had a song that like didn't do that well. I don't think it was because of the song at all. I think it's because right now, you and I both know what Canadian content is, and trying to put out a song in the summer when we have The Weeknd, Drake, and Shawn Mendes, and Justin Bieber all putting out stuff at the same time. There was no room for other Canadians, you know, like that just fucking happens sometimes. Like I remember we were at the radio station in Chicago on the last tour. And we were talking about that. And the program director from the station said that like Maroon 5 had had a song ready to go since April. And they had held off because they didn't want to compete with all the other artists that like the superstars that were releasing stuff over the summer. And so if a band at that level is having to hold off, we did not have good luck.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it makes sense. They do that with movies all the time, right? Like they put out, you know, they don't want to compete at Christmas or in the summertime. So they put it out in November or they put it out in January or February. Absolutely. It makes sense to do it as a musician.
We've got Taylor Swift is releasing something that's like a new Star Wars is coming out. You know, like it's tough to compete sometimes.
Exactly, man. Well, dude, I don't want to take up too much of your time. You guys have a UK and German tour coming up. That's soon, November, right?
Yeah, we're leaving in like 2 weeks.
That should be fun. Anything to tell the people about that? I mean, we have listeners from the UK and from Germany that'll listen, so I'm sure.
I'm excited to go. Yeah, I'm excited to go there. Like, don't you think like touring in Europe is just so fun? Like just as a tourist, because that's one of the things I really like about touring in Europe is like you can kind of be in like a different culture like almost every day, you know?
Oh, absolutely. No, I love it, and I love the German catering so much. That's my favorite part.
The sausages and whatnot.
Oh, dude. I'm vegan, but they do it up proper, man. For vegetarians too. So I love Germany, man. So that's coming up. And also, I wanted to ask you about the solo song you put out. I think it was last year, We Should Be Friends, which was a cool song. I mean, is there more coming on that front?
Oh, that was just, thanks, man. That was like, honestly, that was just like a tune I did for my buddy's indie movie. It was a guy I went to high school with is a filmmaker and stuff, and he had managed to when he was trying to get like it's super hard for those guys to get like funding to make an indie movie, like that's pretty tough. So one of the things they do is like they try and attach as many people to it as possible because it looks better on the forums and stuff. So he had asked me if I would agree to do a song for his movie if he could get it made, and I was like, yeah, man, sure, fucking it. And then I totally forgot about it, and then like. And then like 2 years went by. And then all of a sudden he called me and was like, hey man, like, so do you have that song? We made the movie. And I was like, oh shit. Give me a second. And I'll write something. And he sent me over a copy of the, it was like, you know, 45 minutes too long. So it was like literally.
Hello. Sorry. You turned into a robot for 1 second. Just repeat what that last part.
Oh no. It's just like, I watched the first cut of the movie, which was like, you know, obviously, it's a first cut, so it was like quite long and stuff. But I could get the gist of like what the movie was about and stuff. And then I just took my dog for a walk, and the song popped out. It was fun. It was fun to do something different like that, and do something like kind of like indie and quirky, and like not anything like a Mariana's Trench song. And it was fun.
That's what I liked about it. I liked that it was a stripped down version. You know, like I put it on, I started listening to it, and I was expecting like, all of a sudden, you know, at the 2 minute mark, like it to start sounding like Queen. And it never went there. And I was like, you know what? I actually like Josh's voice kind of in this stripped down thing. And I thought it might be a cool project for you to do at some point, you know, is boil it down to, you know, I always say a great song can be boiled down just to a melody and chords. And, you know, it would be cool to hear you, you know, in that context. So I really like the song. I just wanted to ask you about that.
Oh yeah. Thanks, man. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe, who knows?
Well, man, thank you so much for taking the time speaking with me. What else can we expect from you guys? I mean, I guess the record is still pretty new. Phantoms, it came out earlier this year. Are you doing more shows? What else is up?
Yeah, there's definitely going to be more shows. I think like we haven't done the eastern side of Canada yet, so we got to do that. We haven't announced yet, but like they're working on Australia as well. So yeah, we got a lot more to do. And then I'm gonna get to work and start the whole writing process again, as you do.
I love it. Well, good luck with that. I hope that the songs come quick and easy this time, and not too laborious. But I know they will be. Josh, thank you so much. I always play music at the end of the show. Do you have a Marianas Trench song you'd like to play for the people?
Whatever you want.
Okay, I'll pick one. Sounds good.
Okay.
All right, man. All the best, and enjoy the rest of your day, man.
Thanks, Shane. You too.
Yeah, thank you. So there it is with Josh, and what a story. And we got pretty deep into songwriting there, and I don't pretend to be in the same fucking league as this guy. So it was really cool to pick his brain. And if you're a songwriter, aspiring songwriter, or musician in any way, shape, or form, there was some gold in there for sure. Thank you, everyone, so much for tuning in. Please, please tell a friend, tell a loved one about this show. Let's keep it going. Have your pets spayed or neutered. Help control the pet population. You know, do all the right things. Eat your vegetables. Call your mother. These are all things you need to be doing. But seriously, if you like the show, please tell someone who you think might be into it. I'll be back next week with another episode, another great episode, episode 202, if you're keeping score. But first, I will leave you with a tune. And Marianas Trench has a lot of good tunes. Make sure, if you're not familiar with the band, you should be. Just go on to Spotify. They got tons of songs, tons of albums, tons to dive into. But I'm going to play this one because it's entertaining and because we talked about it in the podcast. It's called Pop 101. Here it is on Lead Singer Syndrome. Peace and love.
Music 101, some simple instructions for a good first impression. Now let's start with a first one. A minor chord tensions grow, fade in the bass like so. Now with momentum, go stop and bring the beat back. It's called four on the floor, a beat you can't ignore. I bring sexy back once more.
Yeah.
Love that.
Yeah.
For sure, the chords are 1, 4, 6, 4. Now I'm talking familiar. Harmony in thirds, not fourths. We'll take you into the pre-chorus. Real quick now, don't you bore us. Hurry up and get to the chorus. Dumb down, they won't ignore us. Get to the floor and hear some words you should know. Like DJ never let me go, or shots and then we'll lose control. Or baby, 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 how about one more last word? Like, hey girl, we've only got tonight. Some things just go together like higher desire and fire, higher desire and fire. Guitar and strings like these to sound like black eyed peas. This one's a filter swing,
this one's a matching heat.
Hipster music on cassette, but you probably don't know that yet. 808s. Oh, hell yeah! Heartfelt pop anthems from Mumford and his sons. Gang vocals, here we come!
I'm thinking I will always wait.
Real quick now, don't you bore us. Hurry up and get to the chorus.
Whoa, and here's the words you should know. Like DJ never let me go. Or shots and then we'll lose control. Or baby, 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 baby. How about one more last word like, hey girl, we've only got tonight. Some things just go together like higher desire and fire, higher desire and fire.
I can pitch shift my voice if I want. I can pitch shift my voice if I want.
Ooh.
I can pitch shift my voice if I want.
Rapper friend, simplify, you slow the beat, abbreviate, feature defeat.
Quick now, fill in the gap,
okay.
Water it down, eliminate that which you really would rap and give them a classic like
get
to the floor.
And here's the words you should know. You're like DJ, never let me go. Or shots and then we'll lose control.
Or
Joshua Ramsey.
Cats and leather boots and cats and boots and cats and boots.